Set your course for the Hoth
Takes podcast.
Welcome to Hoth Takes. I'm Eric Geller.
I'm Grace Seegers.
And I'm Haley Bird Wilt.
And we're here to talk about the middle episodes of The Acolyte, episodes 4 through 6, which take us to a very dark place as a lot of things happen for our heroes and our villain reveals himself in more ways than one. So I thought maybe we should start with the big moment of conflict in episode 5, the huge duel, lightsaber duel on Kofar, as the masked stranger who has been pulling the strings for Mei behind the scenes reveals himself and takes on the Jedi. And well, let's just say things don't go well for our heroes. This was the thing that really has gotten Star Wars fandom buzzing so far about this show. So I figured we could jump in there and then go from there to talk about how things go for all of our main characters. I'd be curious to get your guys' thoughts on this fight, both in terms of what it means for the story of the Acolyte, but then also just as a watershed moment in Star Wars in terms of the fight choreography and just how dark it gets. I mean, for me, I think this is definitely the most brutal thing that we've ever seen in Star Wars. We have, our villain here impaling a Jedi, pulling another Jedi onto the lightsaber blade, and then decapitating them. Jeki gets stabbed 3 times. Yord's neck gets snapped. This is brutal stuff. And on top of some really amazing fight choreography earlier on in the conflict, especially in those one-on-one duels. I mean, I don't think we've ever seen anything like this in Star Wars before, but I would love to know what the two of you thought as you watched this fight.
Well, I loved it, probably predictably, because everyone knows how much I love violent action movies. And this was nice and violent and action-y. I really was so impressed by the fight choreography and the smoothness of it. I do think that this is the best lightsaber fights we've seen in a TV show. I think it blows the other shows out of the water. And I think it's even Kenobi may have gotten close, but I really think that in terms of creativity, in terms of genuine shock value, this is for sure the most exciting fight scene, lightsaber fight scene we've seen in a long, long time. I also really liked how there were very serious and dark consequences. I mean, two of my favorite characters, Yord and especially Jeki, were killed in pretty horrific ways. Jeki at least got a really cool fight scene, two fight scenes, one hand-to-hand with Mei and one with Kimir before she then was stabbed tragically. But yeah, they're dead, and there's no amount of plot armor that will shield them from being super dead. Also, a neck snap, I don't know if that's a first for Star Wars, but it certainly felt like a degree more brutal than we typically see. But I thought it was really cool and refreshing. I actually just rewatched the episode yesterday, and I liked it so much. I liked what a very kinetic episode had to say about what a grown-up Star Wars that's not Andor could be.
I agree in a lot of ways. I think it was really well done choreography, and I think just like the writing of deciding to be willing to kill off characters that already had gained such a beloved following, like the Yord Horde, I'm sure was devastated by this situation. I will say, like, the violence of it, I think I wish it had been, and I don't know how you could really do this, I guess there's like a little warning at the beginning, but I feel like talking to some parents of slightly older kids than mine, so like 5, 6, 7, 8, like they kept watching these kinds of Star Wars shows with their kids, and I don't think they understood that this, like, it was gonna be that dark. Like, the neck snap in particular seems like a little too real world for me. Even then, like, the beheading and the being stabbed 3 times with a lightsaber, I feel like the neck snap is like that happens in the real world like with accidents, and like it's just a little too real. And I had to warn a friend of mine who almost watched this with his daughter, who's way too young to see something like that. I was like, no, don't let her watch episode 5. And she loved Jackie, and like this little girl was like enjoying the show. And so I guess I'm sad that there's kind of that barrier for kids, but I think as an adult, Evan and I loved watching it together. Like we were both like, oh, and like it was well done. I thought it was good.
Yeah, I think that was the first time we've ever seen anybody snap someone's neck with their bare hands, as opposed to the Force, which we see, you know, from Darth Vader and stuff like that. Someone might have done it with a droid in Clone Wars, I guess, but I think this is the first time we've seen someone do it like this before. And Grace, you know, you pointed out that Jackie really gets her hero moment in terms of being a really impressive fighter, certainly more impressive than I would have expected from a Padawan. She gets a really good kind of scene to close out her adventure on the show, but I will say, I think it's a credit to the Acolyte that these deaths landed the way they did, not just because of the brutality of the actual death, but because of how quick it felt. They weren't lingering on it, really. It's not like Qui-Gon's death in The Phantom Menace, where it's a pivot point for the whole Skywalker saga, let alone for Obi-Wan himself. There was something almost careless about this. Certainly for Chimier, it didn't matter to him that he was killing these people. They were ants to him. But we got so much joy out of watching these characters. We got so invested in such a short period of time that it meant something to us, and it felt unfair how quickly they were dispatched like that. And that is a credit, I think, to the writers, and of course to the actors as well, for doing something that we don't see a lot in Star Wars, which is building up characters so that they're the main characters, but then killing them not even as the final battle, but just something in the middle.
I also have been reading some interviews with Daphne Keene, who played Jackie. And I think part of what makes this show interesting is that you can tell there's a lot of thought and care put into it. And Daphne Keene and Leslie Headland, the creator, had apparently put a lot of thought into Jackie's character. And forgive me if you guys saw this, but I read in an interview with Daphne Keene in Vulture that they had come up with this idea that Jackie was a bit of a prodigy and wanted to do the Jedi trials at 18 but was too young, so stayed a Padawan for a while rather than do the Jedi trials. And that's why she's such an interesting mix of being very mature for her age and also being such a good fighter, but not being 18 and not being ready for that. And then that's what makes her really abrupt death even more tragic, is knowing that there was so much potential there that's just cut short. And I think the acting in that episode and in the show overall, I've been really impressed with. And credit to Daphne Keene that we were so attached to Jackie by the time that she is killed. And really, even though we don't have that explicit backstory, we get the sense of who she was and the what's been lost.
I want to say, before we move on to anything else, which I think we're going to have a lot of opinions, I am so grateful to get to see the Darth Jar Jar ethos play out. Yes, it is. It's the fulfillment of what I have been wanting to see, which is there's a silly, goofy guy, and it turns out he is, and Eric called this in the first episode, so like maybe it wasn't maybe it was a little predictable, but I enjoyed it to see this goofy person turn into this was a very threatening, evil guy. And go ahead, Grace.
No, I was just going to say, my husband had that same reaction where in episode 4, he was like, what if this is a Darth Jar Jar situation?
And it
using that exact term. And then he was freaking thrilled when it was a Darth Jar Jar situation. So
my only complaint is like, I wish he was like maybe a little bit goofier for a little bit longer, like to truly make it clear that it was a Darth Jar Jar situation. But I'm still grateful that it happened. And I feel like he did an incredible job becoming so menacing, like, very quickly.
Yeah, I think we all are pretty impressed with Manny Jacinto's performance in this episode. And I want to talk about Chimier, or the Stranger, as he's called in the official marketing material, in a second, because there's a lot to talk about with him. But I want to ask first, you know, at the end of this fight, Saul, you know, really has been destabilized by the deaths of these other Jedi, and he really goes at Chimer and is about to kill him, and Osha sort of snaps him out of it and is like, you know, it's basically saying it's not the Jedi way. I wanted to ask the two of you, because when I was tweeting about this episode, yes, thank you, Haley. Thank you. I wonder what Grace is going to say, but let me just put it out there.
That's my biggest complaint. Yeah,
so
go ahead.
Did Saul do the right thing by letting Chimer live?
No, and first of all, Osha was wrong, and maybe that's foreshadowing of her stupidity in the next episode, but, like, someone who has been in combat and has killed, like, 8 people and who is disarmed for, like, 2 minutes does not suddenly make them non-combatant.
Killed without remorse.
Right, true. It's like, this is not, oh, no, we can't, it's not the Jedi way. He doesn't have his lightsaber for, like, 2 minutes. You can't just kill him. No, that's not how it works. I guess my question for Osha is, like, how long do you have to be disarmed? Is it is it at any point you're disarmed, you can't, like, because then there's no victory at all. There's no victory possible if you can't. I guess is the concept, Eric, in this age of Jedi that you can't kill anyone? Is that in the books?
Definitely not. The Jedi certainly kill people when they have to. And it's funny because Chimer even jokes in the following episode.
That's what I was going to say. Haley, yeah. You sound like Chimer.
Well, no, but Chimer was mocking the idea, I think, that that for the Jedi, there's this artificial boundary between combatant and non-combatant. Mm. And by the way, you don't need a lightsaber to be a threat, as he showed us, not only with Yord, but just with using the Force in general. He is not... Chimer, a person like Chimer, will never be disarmed unless he's unconscious, right? Because he always has the Force he can call on. In brutal ways, and his bare hands. So I mean, thank you, Haley, for saying it. Grace, I'd love to hear what you think, but I think that was so stupid and self-defeating, an insistence on this single principle at the expense of everything else, and you're just making the galaxy a worse place, in my opinion.
It was very Anakin and Mace Windu with the showdown with Sidious. Like, no, you can't do that. It's not the Jedi way.
Well, I think that's a great comparison, too, because I fully agree it was stupid. He was clearly dangerous, killed 8 people in like 5 seconds. He needs to be put down in that particular scenario. And I think Chimer's mocking of it in the next episode, like how much time has to pass, was pretty funny too. But I think that the reason she does it and she stops him isn't necessarily because she's like, that's not the Jedi way. That's the surface level, but I think she is and has been struggling with who the Jedi are, what it means to be a Jedi, and what her sister is. And I think that scene underlines a larger conflict within Osha that then we see in the next episode, because it's really freaking stupid in the moment, but you also see how in the heat of the moment, you know, Saul is probably the only one that Osha still thinks of as kind of like a good guy. And even if Chimer did just murder a whole bunch of people, seeing the one person you trust become angry in a way you've never seen before, that can be shocking. So I understand where it comes from. And I think the Anakin parallels are apt, because Osha, as we see in the next episode, teach corrupt, she is being corrupted. And so I think it was a stupid thing to do, but I also understand it from a narrative standpoint.
Is it just that she's like interested? Because what I don't understand of the writing decision, and I'm forgetting the chronology, so Grace, since you just watched this, you can remind me. She also like tries to get him killed by those moth things, and I guess it's because he's holding his lightsaber, but like went like, is that before or after?
That's after. I don't think she's trying to get him killed. I think she's trying to escape, and because it's pretty clear a few moth things aren't going to kill this guy.
They were kind of scary.
Well, yeah.
I feel like the villagers thought the moth things killed the Jedi in the next episode. So
they did.
They're capable of it.
I just saw it more of as like a shot in the dark rather than that. Oh yeah, these buggies will definitely kill him.
Do we think she's like, I mean, I guess in the next episode, and we'll get to this, I kind of appreciate that it's not immediately jumping into, like, what happened on her home world, but it's, like, she is, it seems like she's being lured by this new kind of power. And so I guess I wonder if you guys think when she says that to Sol, is it just the idealism of, like, I don't want to see you kill someone? Or is it, like, clearly he's really powerful and I want to know why and how?
I think she doesn't want him to kill him in the heat of anger. Like, I think really that is her saying, Sol, like, snap out of it. Like, whatever you're about to do next, it cannot be out of rage. And I actually respect that and agree with that. I think where I might differ from her is, okay, having snapped out of it as he does, you can still end this person's life. And you won't relish it, and you shouldn't relish it, but you can do that as a service to the galaxy, as part of your responsibility to keep the peace.
I think that's a good point. And I think Osha, probably just also looking back at her own childhood, sees the Jedi as very different from how she was raised. And also, we know that she believes that she failed as a Jedi in part because she couldn't let go of her emotions. So when she sees Sol unable to let go of his emotions, that's when she really freaks out.
Yeah. So I do want to dive into what happens on Chimer's hidden planet. And as I said, you know, I'm really impressed with Manny Jacinto's performance here. He nails the physicality of this role. He's so creepy at so many points, both on Kofar and then, you know, also has this kind of disorienting charm to him on his own sort of hidden planet there. He's got this refreshing quirkiness that I think makes him an interesting villain, even if some of his values, as we'll talk about, are sort of classic Sith ideology. But just as a person, he's different enough that I think it's really exciting. And I think he is very slick and very clever about trying to corrupt Osha. You know, everything he does is done trying to sound reasonable, sympathetic in a way that perhaps the Jedi did not seem sympathetic or reasonable to Osha. He builds everything around the role of emotion. And he also, you know, as many people, including Leslie Headland, have talked about, there's big Reylo energy with that sixth episode where he brings her to his planet and he tries to sort of corrupt her, but mostly with this almost kind of charm offensive. I mean, he does kind of use his, like, his physical attractiveness, his charm, his charisma to kind of tempt Osha over to his side. And we'll talk in a second about kind of how he centers this on the ways that the Jedi are perhaps a little too inflexible, or at least what he thinks is too inflexible about emotion. But first, I'm curious if the two of you were as struck as I was by that first scene on the planet where he knows she's following him, and he, you know, he goes skinny dipping, basically. Has Star Wars ever done a scene like that where there is a character who is, you know, who's naked, even though we don't see any nudity? I can't think of anything.
I mean, there's some, like, suggestive scenes in Andor, but this was new.
And, you know, the real difference between this and Reylo is that Chimer is charismatic.
And Grace, when you say charismatic, that's obviously a euphemism, right?
We're being appropriate here.
We're being
Eric,
appropriate, Eric.
Yes, of course. I'm just saying he's a physically attractive man. That's all I'm saying.
Listen, the man, as I said, killed two of my favorite characters, and all I could think about was how smoking hot he was. So, like, that's attractiveness. But, you know, he has this very seductive charisma, and I don't even mean that in a seductive, like, romantic way. I mean, he's just very good at making his perspective seem reasonable, and part of that, I think, is talking in this really casual tone of voice. Like, he's not portentous or, you know, sounding like a harbinger of doom like other Sith we've heard. He sounds like an ordinary guy who's just trying to be reasonable. And even when he has a lightsaber to Mei's head and has just done all this murder, Sol says, "What do you want?" And Chimer is just like, "Freedom." And he says it so casually, which also I think is a connection back to the witches that raised Mei and Osha, because they said what they wanted too was freedom. And, you know, there is that question of, okay, there's freedom, there's power, but actually good and bad does matter too. But he's very good at framing it in a way that makes it seem reasonable, and he's very good at making Osha question herself. So when he's talking about, you know, did Jeki actually like you? Yord was willing to sell you out. Your master wasn't there for you. The Jedi were never there for you. And he's turning all of Osha's fears against her in this very sly way. That is part of why I think he's so effective, is because he's not coming at her with aggression. He's very much turning on the charm offensive, but in a, like, I'm just a normal, super duper hot guy kind of way.
I think, so I see your point on all of that. I think the writing in the sixth episode could have been better, because I wasn't super convinced that she would have forgotten the carnage and, like, the deaths of so many people so quickly in that forest. And the fact that she does really bothers me. And I understand he's standing there naked and, like, maybe she's enjoying it. Which I appreciate. Okay, I do appreciate seeing, like, an actual seduction to the dark side. And you both know that I have wanted to see more romance in Star Wars. I don't know if I would have chosen for it to be this particular story. But I do think, and he does mention it at some point where, like, the friendship and the love that Osha had for Jeki and, like, her other Jedi friends would never be, like, reciprocated to the same degree that she feels it, because the Jedi are limited in that way. And I think that's a very, like, I don't know, I think he's, like, offering her something, like a deep emotional attachment that's, like, sort of illicit to the Jedi. And I do think that's seductive in a way. And so, like, I enjoy seeing that aspect of it. I just don't think the writing in that episode was, like, super convincing to me, because it was so, like, so quickly after. I wish she would have, like, tried to, I don't know, fight back a little more. Like, she's just kind of, like, tagging along behind him, like, asking really dumb questions, because she doesn't want to actually have the fight. She's already given up.
I'd agree with that.
I guess I read it more as, and I will say, at first I was like, it's not believable that this person would be so credulous. And I guess I read it more as, she can't turn away. She's so fascinated by this person. She's so enthralled, not necessarily in terms of, like, buying into it, but just, like, the existence of this person, she needs to know more. She has, like, almost an addiction to just learn more. Again, not necessarily because she wants to follow him. I think time will tell on that one, but more just, like, she needs to understand what has happened here that led to this moment. If I were being charitable, that would be my explanation, is everything that happens from just having the conversation to at the end putting the helmet on, she just wants to know more. And I think if she ends up turning to the dark side, that will make this a pretty effective illustration of how sometimes just curiosity can be dangerous. Like, I, as a general rule, I would not say that, but I think it's possible in Star Wars that there is this idea that if you're just intellectually curious about the Sith, that can tip over without you even necessarily being conscious of it into just actually participating.
That's a good point. I just wish there was, like, a little more. And, like, she shows flashes of it a couple of times, but, like, by the end of the episode, she's just, like, she doesn't care that he killed her friends. And maybe it's just, like, even in the questions that she asked, they could have been better questions. Like, they seem weak. They seem like dumb questions when you're listening to it. And they seem like the questions of someone who, like, doesn't want to have to make the decision they know is correct. Like, the moral decision. Like, she's putting off morality to learn more, kind of what you're saying, Eric, of, like, but it's not really learning more. It's just, like making excuses.
I feel like I...
Yeah.
No, I'm sorry for interrupting. I feel like I kind of agree with both of you that it's like a mix of she's curious and... but she's already given up. And I will say, this is not the first really dumb decision we've seen Osha make. Like, in episode 4, when Saul is like, let's get out of here, this creepy tree section, and then she immediately touches the thing that are obviously bugs on the tree. Like, why the heck did you do that? But I think that Osha, since we've seen her, has been in a period of complete emotional turmoil. And that makes sense to me because she has this traumatic background, because she thought her sister was dead and all of a sudden she isn't, because this Jedi Order that she left 6 years ago has come back in a big way, and she's suddenly questioning all of the choices that she's made and all the things that led her to the Jedi, all the things that led her to leave. I think, and this is my charitable interpretation, she's not exactly in her right mind. She's not in a great state. In the past 2 days, she's found out her twin sister that she thinks killed her entire family is alive, and reconnected with Sol, and then made friends, lost friends. I don't think she's in a place where things are making a lot of sense to her right now. And I think partially she's trying to understand how May got to be how she is, trying to understand just what's happening. But I also think there is a part of her, kind of like Haley is saying, that has maybe, if not given up, then is taking this path knowingly or with the instinct that it's wrong and taking it anyway. And I think a big part of that is just the emotional upheaval that she's had.
And she's also, I mean, as we have seen, she is very bad at controlling her emotions. I mean, Chimera is able to very quickly exploit that to get her to attack him. And she obviously doesn't kill him, but she falls for that trap anyway. And we know that the reason she left the Jedi Order, as she says here, is because she basically couldn't cut it. Like, they needed her to tamp down her emotions, to control them, to master them, and she could not do that. And I think there's an undercurrent in some of the commentary about the show that we're supposed to feel bad for Osha for flunking out of the Jedi because of her emotional imbalance, and we're supposed to blame the Jedi for having unfair standards. I've seen some people kind of talk about it that way, and I actually think that it's kind of unfair to put it that way. I think that the Jedi are extremely powerful people, and they do need to control their emotions to avoid hurting other people, to avoid hurting innocent people. They need to behave commensurately with their power level. And so if Osha could not do that, if she was already showing signs that she wouldn't be able to do that, I think leaving was the most responsible decision she's ever made. But I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on kind of her emotional state and maybe how that connects to why she is so vulnerable to Chimera's manipulations here.
I guess the Jedi don't offer, like, you would know more about this, Eric. If you've been through a really traumatic situation, I guess the Jedi just kind of teach, this is the way of things. And, like, you know, everybody has returned, the people who die return to the Force.
I mean, yeah, Jeki even says that about Indara, I think, when they first arrive on Kofar. Like, Osha is like, I could never get that comfortable with death. And Jeki's like, you know, and this is a thing in Star Wars, both in canon and in Legends, the idea of, like, don't mourn those, like Yoda actually I think says this to Anakin in episode 3, where it's like, you know, don't mourn those who pass on, like embrace the fact that this is part of their journey. Like, that's definitely a thing that the Jedi do teach,
and that's it holds no room for like actual grieving.
Yeah.
And I think like there are religions on Earth like this where it's like when you die you become part of the universe, and it's like, okay, but also like the separation is unholy, like between you and your loved ones when death happens. Like, it's an outrage. And I think most people feel that like deep inside when they actually experience it. It's unnatural. It like we hate, like it's evil. And I think like in Osha's defense, having gone through that, she probably feels that way. And the Jedi are not giving her the tools or even like the religious sanction to have those emotions.
And you could probably argue, too, that the stupid decisions that she continues to make in episode 6 are out of grief, in a sense, and just this feeling of being disconnected. And here's someone who's offering an explanation to her. And she's been separated from Sol. She's been brought to this planet. She doesn't know where she is. Like, sure, technically she could swim to a ship and then try to figure it out, but that doesn't seem super safe. And it's more of a kind of illusion of freedom type thing. Like, well, it's your choice whether you want to swim out really far to that ship and hijack it and figure out where you are and get back to the Jedi Temple. I think she is pretty trapped there, and there's a guy who can offer answers for why she feels the way that she does. And even as much as she hates it, and as much as she may be bitter towards him, there's something, again, to use this word, seductive about just having an answer for things as well.
I want to know what, like, stew he made for them.
Of course you do. Of course you do.
I was like, what is that? What's the seduction stew?
Well, and ladies, we like a man who can cook.
We do. She's like, yes, this is kind of nice. But what I love is that there's always, like, a random ship on these islands with the mentor. There's a way to get out if you can, like, if you have enough willpower to, like, lift it out of the lagoon or something.
I am curious what we're supposed to make of Chimer's philosophy on the Jedi. I mean, this comes back to, like, our whole conversation about the witches and, like, what does the show want us to think about these people? But I've definitely seen some people saying, like, you've got to hand it to Chimer. Like, the Jedi the Jedi are too restrictive about emotion. They do suppress the freedoms of other Force users. Like, Chimer is out here saying, I just want to be able to wield my power. The Jedi don't let you have any emotions. If you want to be emotional at all, you can't be a Jedi. By the way, that's not true.
You can do that without murdering people.
Well, yes, definitely. But also, I thought it's just like, are we supposed to put stock in his arguments? Because he's completely distorting the Jedi's policy on emotions. Like, he's not being truthful. He's more, I think it was Grace who was saying that he sounds reasonable, like, just his tone. And so that separates him from someone like Palpatine, who's very much like the cackling cartoon villain. And that's true. And that is impressive. And I like that about him. But I hate sounding like I'm trying to, like, lecture Star Wars fandom, but, like, I wish that more folks could separate, like, how he presents himself from, like, the actual substance of his arguments and, like, understand that he is not the victim here. You do not, in fact, have to hand it to him. He is the bad guy. Like, am I alone in thinking that the show is, like, trying to present this as more of a question?
So I think in the episode with the witches, we were supposed to think that. And I think just having seen him kill so many people, And just the feeling of, like, she's making a bad moral decision in episode 6. Like, I don't think the show wants us to think he's the good guy anymore.
Yeah.
And I don't think so. I don't think so. And, like, if people do, it's just because they find him attractive. I've read the tweets, and I feel like most of the Chimer defense is just that they like the way he looks.
And Eric, I think you're wrong about that. The episode's literally called Teach Corrupt, and it's pretty clear that it's corruption. Again, he also did very much murder a whole bunch of people. Just because Osha's in a confused state doesn't mean that we, the viewer, are also in a confused state.
I would actually argue this is like galaxy brain. So many social conservative people hate this show. And they have hated it since before it came out, by the way. But
wonder
like
why.
They find wonder why. But they find reasons to complain each week. And I think, like, Galaxy Brain take, the way it is telling us a story of someone using language of, like, freedom and oppression to do objectively evil things is actually kind of conservative. We'll see.
Wow.
We'll see where the story goes.
Ooh, we gotta
wow,
be
that's
careful
real
there.
Galaxy Brain. I'm gonna sidestep that one real quick. I would just say the people, I don't think I've actually seen anyone defending Chimer. All I've seen are people saying he is smoking hot, and that's true. Like, Your Honor, he did very much do all that. But he's just also a babe and a half, and I think you can hold these two truths in your hands at the same time, and I'm sorry for a dog barking in the hallway.
That's all right. I guess my concern, or like my like dubiousness, is the show has been marketed as this exploration of provocative, contrarian ideas about the Jedi, and like, we're really going to show you a different kind of dark side user. We're going to show you the ambiguity in
a hot
like,
one.
Yeah, like, we're going to show you a person who's disarmingly non-Sith in a lot of ways, even if they are very Sith in other ways, and we're going to show you the Jedi as not necessarily the shining good guys that they were discussed as in the original trilogy. I guess in that context, I'm a little leery of like what we could understand as a cut and dry, you know, depiction of bad. The show wants us, I think, in general, to question the Jedi and to give some credibility to people who criticize them. So I hope you're right that there's not supposed to be any ambiguity here, but that felt a little like, oh, like, how does this fit into the grand project of the Acolyte?
What do you want? Like a disclaimer at the end?
If we're supposed to think Chimaer is a good guy after episode 5, which is like an unprovoked massacre of people who did, like, the, like, I just think that's really bad writing and, like, not even, there's no moral compass there. And I'm going to give the writers a little more credit than that. I think they put that in the series to, like, make it very clear, like, he's not, like you're saying, Eric, he's not, like, the representative for this, like, the perfect viewpoint of, like, maybe the Jedi have something, you know, wrong here. And, like, we've seen that explored in the prequels already, and so I don't even think that's necessarily new ground to question the Jedi as an institution. I think the more compelling story here is, and we'll see what happens later, of course, so, you know, maybe I'm wrong, is just, like, using this language and using this really convincing rhetoric to do evil things. And the fact that Osha, like, as a viewer, and I don't know if you guys felt the same way, but, like, watching her be seduced to the dark side by this guy who killed so many people just, like, a few minutes before she wakes up is really agonizing to see. It's like, you throw away morality in pursuit of, like, a vague concept of justice or, like, a vague concept of a better future. And it's like, what is it? What is it that he's promising her?
Well, I liked when you were talking about how, like, it's seductive, but in a way that we don't usually use that word, because there's a moment where he says to her, like, when you lose everything, that's when you're most free, right? And that is such an insidious idea if you think about it, because, like, what he's really saying is when you lose the people in your life, you also lose the sort of the obligation to, like, respect sort of norms of society, because you don't have anybody who will judge you for doing otherwise. Like, you have been so alienated from everyone around you because you don't have the people you actually care about that you will not face any real consequences for behaving asocially, for behaving sociopathically, right? Like, there is something seductive about I can drop the facade almost, or, like, I can stop being on my best behavior, to put it very sort of crudely. Like, I don't owe society anything. Everything has been taken from me. That is such a seductive idea, especially if you have had everything taken from you. And I really do like the way that they're showing us him putting that to her, because I think it's an attractive idea to her.
I would go even beyond that and say I think it's a very classic tactic of abuse by a domestic abuser is to isolate someone from the people who love them and the people that they love. So in this episode, again, he is telling her to question the people that she trusted, the people that she was friends with, her mentor, you know, the people she had just met, but also people she'd known for a really long time. And he's telling her they don't actually love you. They can never feel the same way that you do. And the implication being that I can, I'm the only one who can. But even more than that, the dark side of the Force is the only thing that can really fulfill you. And he's doing this technique of beginning to cut her off from other parts of the world and people she appreciates. And that's also part of when you lose everything, you are free. So get rid of those people that you love and that love you. You just lose them. Then only then will you be truly free. So I think it's even more insidious than just you're free when you no longer have an obligation to society. I think he's actively trying to cut her off from the person that she could and should be.
Before we move on from Chimaer, a couple of quick things, one of which I'm curious what folks think of the setup that they seem to be doing in episode 6 with Vernestra, where Chimaer kind of shows Osha this scar on his back right before we see Vernestra, who's back on Kofar, use her light whip in a sort of very throwaway moment to kill one of the bugs. And it got me thinking, could Vernestra have been his Jedi Master, and could she have, you know, pushed him away or tried to kill him even when it became clear that he was a true Darksider? She does have a moment in this episode where she's trying to figure out who could have done this massacre, and she kind of murmurs to herself something to tip the scales, which is the same phrase that she used in a previous episode. So it got me thinking, is she like reflecting on something that he maybe told her during their final confrontation, and could she be really aware at this point that these have all the markings of Chimaer, who is still alive out there, and are we going to perhaps see her try to cover that up or something as we move forward?
She's such a bureaucrat, it bothers me.
I did not put together that whip thing at all. I think that makes a lot of sense, that would make a lot of sense. I could see that happening, but I genuinely, the thought had not crossed my mind until you mentioned it, so I have no comment beyond, yeah, that could happen.
Eric, I feel like you know a bit more background here since you read the books with her in them. And when I see her, I'm like, who's this green lady? Why is she so concerned about politics?
Yeah, I'm sad for you, Eric, because you said you didn't like her.
I mean, it's just like, I really hope that people are saying like maybe she will blame Sol as a way of covering up Chimaer's involvement, because that could be traced back to her, because she does have a moment on the planet where the other Jedi is like, could Sol have done this? And she's like, that is a big accusation, son. I really hope they do not make her like a backstabbing sort of pseudo villain. Like,
They've been building up to like cleaning things up for politics' sake.
Yes.
And, like, that's her outlook on life. And I don't know why. I wish we, like, if she's going to be that way, I wish there was a little more reason given to us for, like, why she feels she's under so much pressure to, like, maintain this image for the Jedi. But there, like, again, that's another interesting story that maybe they'll explore later, of, like, the institutional expectations of, like, perfection allow the Jedi. And we see this in the prequels, too, of, like, they're covering up their imperfections in a way that prevents them from actually responding to really real threats against them. So it wouldn't be like super surprising to me if she blames Sol and it's like this ridiculous thing. But like Sol is kind of, he's going off the grid to solve his own emotional problems and like do this little mission without a conference call or like a Zoom meeting beforehand. And I don't know, that deserves some kind of sanction. If not being pinned with the blame for murdering all those people, you know?
Yeah, he's definitely not making things look good for himself. And we do see a scene in episode 6 where Vernestra is talking to a senator, and he's basically saying, don't worry too much about this audit of the Jedi that this other senator wants to do. He's basically just showboating, but the Jedi are always honest with the Senate, so you have nothing to worry about. And I love that scene because I really hope we get more of this political layer of the current context for the Jedi. This idea of an audit of the Jedi is so fascinating, and what that implies about the Senate's posture toward the Jedi, the level of trust or lack of trust that must exist at this point. And of course, it is ironic because Vernestra is covering up a whole lot, not only to the Senate, but to the Council. I hope we see more about that. I thought we wouldn't see any more after that earlier episode, and here we are getting another scene. It feels kind of like a throwaway thing, but it also very much feels like it could be something that in the next two episodes becomes like the foreground that kind of pushes Vernestra to try to cover something up. So I don't know. I like that element of the Jedi have their hands full, but they also have to worry about how they present themselves to the Senate. That is a nice layer to add on to it.
Grace, I want to come back to you on something you mentioned in our last episode.
Yes.
You were giving May some reasonable doubt that, like, maybe she's not the worst person in the world. And I was like, she is the worst person in the world. Have you seen her? She's, like, setting things on fire. She's got this mischievous look on her face. She's bad. And I just want to say, like, okay, she's done bad things. And, like, the more that we've seen, I really did actually appreciate the story arc of, like, she casts off the chains of revenge, almost, where it's like, wait, my sister is alive. I don't have to be under the yoke of this random guy who's decided I'm his student. And I don't have to go kill all these people with no weapon. And I wish she had reached that realization without her, like, realizing her sister was alive to, like, prompt it. Because it is a kind of oppression to be under that, like, the desire for revenge. And what she was doing was, like, objectively wrong. Even, like, regardless of what
happened, and like we don't really even know what they did wrong, but it's like vigilante justice is probably not the answer. It sounds like Sol probably didn't tell like the Jedi Council what actually happened, so like I'm interested to see what happens there. But I do appreciate that turn for her, like as a character. I don't love seeing Osha go to the dark side, and I hope she doesn't stay that way, but like seeing Mei like come to that realization of like that, like there's more for me, like life can continue, I don't have to just be bent on revenge. I appreciate that. I hope to see more of that.
You know, I see her as a bit of a disaster.
She is. Yeah. She still is. And she still is a bad person.
Yeah.
I
saw someone online compare her to Maul. And I think that's a very apt comparison because these are two kind of big messes who are driven by emotion and have all these grand plans that they always mess up, largely due to their own incompetence. And they seem really badass, but are actually just kind of like messes who are constantly failing. And I think we really see that in these three episodes, where something that's so interesting about Mei is that her biggest flaw is possessive love, and that possession that she feels about her sister, that obsession. So she decides, okay, I'm going to go after my sister. But really, you totally did not realize that the Jar Jar you were with was Darth the whole time. Like, that is a huge oversight on your part. And then in the next episode, just consistently trying and failing to run away, first from Jeki and then from Chimaer. And then even when she gets with her sister, she has that very Anakin line of the Jedi have turned you against me. And then she ends up beating up her sister. And you just kind of get the sense that really none of this has turned out her way. She gets found out by Saul. She's bad at making decisions. She's bad at a lot of things that she tries. And most of her plans go very awry, and I think part of that is because her mind is so one track and she is so obsessive. But I am really interested to learn more about her background. I still think she has an inherent darkness in her that is very apparent from the third episode, but I also think that there is more to the story that we will probably see. I'm not saying she's good, because she's not, but she's also kind of endearingly almost a bit of a relatable disaster.
Okay, here's my biggest writing complaint. She decides she doesn't have to like do this vengeance mission anymore because her sister's alive. She's like, why am I doing this? And then she leaves her sister to lie there in the dirt, unconscious, and she, like, goes to be, her imposter for no real... Like, why is she doing that?
Thank you, Haley.
Why doesn't she stay with her sister? She leaves her there for Manny Jacinto to seduce!
So I think, and this, it may be me giving a bit benefit of the doubt, but, you know, we see in the third episode, Mei is like, well, if you're not going to stay here, then I'll kill you, which is such an insane reaction to someone being like, yeah, I'm going to leave. Like, you'd think, well, if you kill her, that also is not going to give you the response that you want. She's gone either way. So it very much felt that way to me. Like, the Jedi have turned you against me, so I'm going to do something that will defeat the Jedi. Like, just some kind of dumb idea logic of, like, they've turned you against me, so I will defeat them somehow, and then I'll come back, and then you'll see.
I'm gonna go get on a ship where I can't, like, there's no way to escape. Like, it just seems like, why?
Yeah, I actually don't give quite as much grace, no pun intended, to the writers and to Meg here. I see this not as a person who is a mess, but as writing that is a mess. You have a character who says, I'm going to turn myself into the Jedi. The only thing I care about is OSHA. Nothing else matters. And then in the next episode, yes, she understands that the Jedi are not exactly a safe haven for her, but she doesn't try to talk to Jeki at all. She just goes right into fighting. She doesn't do anything to try to help the Jedi. At the end of the episode, when she confronts OSHA, there's no attempt to say, hey, you were all that mattered to me. I just want to be with you. Can we get out of here with Saul? You know, Chimera does not seem to be a threat anymore as far as they know in that moment. I just want to get out of here. I'm willing to tell you everything I know. There's none of that. As soon as OSHA is like, actually, the Jedi are pretty good and have given me a great life, it's instantly May regresses to like, no, Jedi bad, May good. And it's like... That's not, I understand. Sometimes the character is conflicted and behaves irrationally. That, I get that. To me, this feels more like the writing is not very good.
Well, the writing is like, here's the problem. The writing wants to get them both to where they are, which is that there's like a switcheroo happening, which in their defense, I love the concept of the twin yes. switcheroo. Like one of them is evil to begin with, and boom, the other twin is now the evil twin. I love that. Good. But, like, it would have probably been more convincing to have her revelation of, like, oh, my sister is all that matters. I don't need to be on this revenge journey after. Like, if she had gone, if she had tried to pretend to be her sister and gone with Saul in, like, in pursuit of revenge before having her realization, I think that would have been a lot more, like realistic writing than, like, her weird, I'm just a weirdo decision-making process.
My biggest issue with this show is I think it is uneven in that kind of storytelling, in showing what characters are thinking. And part of that, I think, is because we don't know the full story of what happened when they were kids and OSHA joined the Jedi. And I think this is going to be a situation where a lot of decisions retroactively make more sense when you have the full story. Not necessarily this decision, because it doesn't make much sense on a surface level. And I think, Haley, you're right that mostly it's just because the writers are trying to get them into that switcheroo place. But if I were in charge, I would have revealed the information about what happened earlier. I think they've dragged it out a bit too long, and I would have maybe given a couple more episodes, because it's that thing you've talked about, Eric, before, and that I think is generally wrong with streaming, is that you try to fit all this story into 8 to 10 episodes, and then things feel rushed or character choices don't make as much sense. If you just had more time to develop things, then it might feel more natural, but you don't, so it just feels really rushed.
Yeah, and I will say, if the reveal of what actually happened retroactively makes some of these character choices make more sense, I wouldn't call that good storytelling. There are ways to do that where you start seeing something, and then only later do you learn something that makes you go, oh, okay. But when it's like so much of one major character's whole behavior, when it's like that integral to the previous episodes, you just kind of go, oh, okay, so that's what was happening there. But like, that doesn't mean that my experience of those earlier episodes suddenly becomes better. Like, I'm still watching something that is confusing me and not making sense to me. And not in the like, this is a Sherlock Holmes mystery where there are clues being dropped, but in the just like, this feels incoherent. And so if that is going to be their plan, then I would say, yeah, you should have done that a few episodes earlier so that we could at least get most of the show understanding what really happened.
This is a personal gripe, but I hate the flashback, like, model, and I'm sad. I feel like the next episode is going to be a bit like a flashback episode, like the whole thing.
Yeah.
There will be another whole episode where it's a flashback, and it's like, I wish we didn't have to.
Well, speaking of the flashbacks, and I think you're right, now that Saul has May in his clutches, you know, which, by the way, like, if we could talk about Saul for a minute.
I didn't like her, him tying her up like that. It bothered me.
This is a guy who's very much, I wouldn't say off the deep end, but, like, clearly has been jolted out of his sense of calm and composure. He is doing things that Jedi should not be doing. Not only, like, fleeing the sector instead of meeting up with the Jedi who are sent to rendezvous with him. I mean, he could tell them right there about Chimer, but he doesn't. He runs away because he's gotten in his head that he's going to save Osha. Again,
some
you have this...
more of them are going to die because of his, like, refusal to tell them what happened.
Yes, and I think that's a great example of this episode is showing you why it is so important to control your emotions. Because if he had prioritized the greater good, he would wait around, tell them about Chimer, and then make the case for a rescue mission. But he is driven by his attachment to Osha, so he goes off on a mission that I think it's safe to say is probably not going to be successful, because the Jedi Order is not going to learn about Chimer, and so that is going to end up leading to more people getting hurt. And as you said, Haley, that outcome is assured based on his choice here. And so it's another example of how, yes, running off to save the person you care about, it often feels right, and that's why it's so hard to be a Jedi, because sometimes what feels right is actually not what is right. And I like that we're seeing Saul have to grapple with that. I like that at first you meet him in the show and he is that dad Jedi that you love, right? And now it's like kind of uncomfortable a little bit because he's not, we haven't found out whatever he did on Brendok. We haven't seen that yet. And we also haven't seen him do anything overtly evil, right? But we're starting to see sort of disturbing choices, whether it's physically restraining Mei or, like, you know, just running off in the first place to pursue Osha. Like, it's unsettling. We're starting to see, like, okay, this is a person who something has gotten to him. He is disturbed by the combination of what has happened in the present and being reminded of his past.
I like that point that it is disturbing, because, like, when his line about, like, I've been thinking of what I would say to you for, like, however many years, and you're gonna listen, it has this vibe of, like, you're stuck here until you forgive me for my war crimes. And, like, I hate that. you can't tie someone else and force them to listen to you, and then, like, they're like, fully under your, like, they are... their life is in your hands, and you're, like, asking for her forgiveness. I feel like we're going to see that, and I don't like it. It's icky. I don't like it.
I think that's deliberate, as Eric
is
saying.
No. I'm just saying, like, Saul is probably, like, I feel like I like the writing that he is devolving into, like, what it's going to make the revelation of what happened probably more, like, believable. Of, like, this guy doesn't always make the best decisions. There's a darker undercurrent here. It just makes me sad to see, I guess.
I will say, as far as Saul is concerned also, I've been pretty critical of this whole, like, how can you not tell that that's Mei? Like, Osha was your student for all these years. You, like, you met them at the same time and very clearly grew close to one of them. And you can't tell that that's Mei? Like, Basil has to come and tell you that that's Mei? There's, like, a line in the episode where they're talking about Chimer, and she says, sometimes when we really want something, it can cloud our judgment. And I get that, I guess, but were you two as bothered as I very clearly was by, like, Saul not picking that up right away?
All his friends were just murdered. Like, in his defense, he's also having a hard time. But I, like, is the reason he realizes, like, I feel like the pip being set to factory settings, I feel like he actually noticed that.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Like, I don't know if the tracker guy actually is the reason.
I actually also thought it was unclear whether he, like, a part of him didn't know it wasn't Osha. It felt to me like it could have been either way. But I also thought that Pip was the confirming.
Is Pip gone forever?
So as an expert on droid software,
please tell us.
No, I also am curious if maybe Osha has backed him up somewhere. If, like, there's, like, on the ship computer, is there, like, a restore point that they can restore to where it's like, oh, don't worry, we backed him up right before the beginning of this mission. Because if not, I think he's gonzo.
No.
Yeah, it was also very, like, not callous, I guess, but, like, it was so quick. Like, he didn't get, like, a death moment, I guess. Like, it was very just like, well, what if I reset you to factory settings? And then she just does it. And it's like, again, it feels very much in keeping with this idea of, like, there's nothing precious about a lot of these characters. They don't get that final hurrah moment. Like, R2-D2, if you were ever reset to factory settings, well, it would be the worst day of my life, I can tell you that. But it would also, on the whatever medium it was being presented in, it would be a big moment. But this is just, like, nothing.
Do you think the show is coming at us with a very, like, nihilist philosophy? Is that the problem?
I don't know, because I think that's Chimer's perspective. And as you guys were saying, I think the show is generally pretty good about signposting that he's in the wrong. I think it's more just that, like, these aren't Anakin and Obi-Wan. Like, these aren't the A-Team. We're supposed to get attached to people and then be reminded that, like, nobody has that shiny plot armor around them at this point in the timeline. And by the way, that's actually a very, like, that's very High Republic of them. Like, the books and comics that this era was started in, they have killed many kind of bright, shining, like, A-level heroes. Like, nobody is safe in those books and comics, which is something that has made it popular with fans, is that they've met people who have been very clearly, like, on the covers of the books and everything, and then they're just killed. And they get big deaths, but, like, they still die. And so I think this show has picked up on that very nicely in terms of, you know, you like Yor, you like Jeki, or at least you want to talk about them. And then they don't get that big death scene. So I think that the Pip thing is kind of fits into that of, like, this is just a world where these people aren't precious. This is not the chosen one. And also, like, you don't know that they live because they're in something later. Like, they're really making good use out of that. And I hope Lucasfilm pays attention to the fan reaction to that and sees that it's very effective. And as much as people don't like that the characters are dying, I think we generally like living in a world where it can happen. I think there's something fresh and exciting about that.
You mean you like that there's a story and the main point is the story, and it's not that everyone needs to survive so that they can continue to advertise for various different Lucasfilm projects and shows until the end of time?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
I do like that. Although I will say, having said, as we wrap up here, having said that there's no characters who we know have to survive, they did put Ki-Adi Mundi in this show, which I think was a very funny choice, particularly because they're walking right up to the line of him finding out about the Sith, which I think is, like, a very kind of out of universe, kind of a fun little poke at him of, like, the dude gets so close to learning about the Sith, but obviously, as we know, he never does.
Oh, can I say something before we end?
Yes.
Okay, I think Chimer is the Acolyte, by the way, in his, like, comment in the last episode with the scars and all that. He's the Acolyte. There's some, like, big bad guy who's going to show up and kill him at the end because he's making too much noise.
Interesting. I read it as he's the Sith apprentice who is trying to recruit an Acolyte so that when he overthrows his master, he becomes the master and the Acolyte is his apprentice. And Leslie Headland has talked about the idea that the Acolyte is the person that the Sith apprentice is seeking out to make their student. So, but also, we didn't even talk about this, but they play Kylo's theme at the end of episode 5 as Chimer is looking at Osha's body. And so there's a question of, you know, plus he's got these ripped arms and, like, which he's very conspicuously showing, and he looks a lot like the Ren character in the comics, who's like Kylo Ren ends up killing him and becoming Ren. And so there's a speculation, is Chimer going to turn out to be the first Ren who starts the Knights of Ren? And I guess what we could see is his master finds out that he's trying to train an Acolyte and either tries to kill him or just spurns him. And that's what leads him to create the Knights of Ren. That's one theory out there anyway. But I always read it as he's the Sith apprentice and he's trying to train an Acolyte.
That's also how I read it. I will say, I think Kylo Ren is a deeply boring character, and I do not care at all about his connection to the Acolyte. But that sure would be a plot that could happen.
I guess what I'm not saying they're mutually exclusive. Like he's trying to have an Acolyte of his own, but what I'm saying is I feel like he was an Acolyte who was cast off, and, like, there is going to be someone somehow even more powerful than him who shows up.
Oh, I think that's definitely true. I do think we're going to meet his master. Can't wait to see what the next two episodes hold. All right, thank you so much for listening to this episode of Hoth Takes. If you want to share your thoughts about the episode or suggest topics for future shows, you can email us at hothtakes@gmail.com, or you can find us on Twitter at hothtakes. I'm Eric Geller on Twitter. Grace is Grace_Seegers, and Haley is Burdenator. Haley made our wonderful logo and banner art, and I edited the show and put together our music. Although, again, for legal purposes, we should note that all Star Wars music and sound effects are the intellectual property of Lucasfilm. You can find a complete archive of past episodes on our website, hottakes.wordpress.com. And if you like the show, please share it with a friend. You can find Hot Takes on all the major podcasting platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. We will see you next time. May the Force be with you.